or run an art gallery, combining excellence and values in such a way that it has an impact on many others who are working in the field. These moves would allow you to serve the work at a whole new level. None of this will happen, however, unless you begin thinking deeply about your kind of work now. Only then will you be ready to make the changes if and when the opportunity presents itself. Work in the hope that God will open such doors for you in the future. Chapter 12. New Power for Work. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart. Colossians chapter 3, verse 23. The Work Under the Work. After finishing her psychiatry residency, a young doctor was working at a New York City hospital. She was friends with a doctor who was a few years ahead of her and who was pregnant with her second child. "Do you know what I love most about being pregnant?" the older doctor said to a friend one day. "I love being pregnant because it's the only time where I feel productive all the time. Even when I'm sleeping, I'm doing something." It struck the young MD that her friend based her self-regard so completely on productivity that she seemed relieved to finally find a task she could do incessantly. She reflected, "For many of us, being productive and doing becomes an attempt at redemption. That is, through our work, we try to build our worth, security, and meaning." Many people are trying to get a sense of self through productivity and success, but that burns them out. For others, the motivation is to bring home a paycheck so they can enjoy real life, but that makes work into a pointless grind. These motivations are what we could call the work beneath the work, and they are what make work so physically and emotionally exhausting in the end. Though Jesus' 12 apostles left their nets after meeting him, see Luke chapter 5, verse 11, we later see them continuing their trade of fishing. We see Paul continuing to work as a tent maker while he worked as an evangelist. These are not men who meet Christ and stop their secular work or who dial back their intensity and passion. Instead, what forever changed was the disciples' relationship to their work. Jesus gave them the big picture. In fact, he was the big picture. He very deliberately called them to a kind of fishing beyond their fishing. "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people." Luke chapter 5, verse 11. In other words, he was coming to redeem and heal the world, and he invited his disciples to be part of this project. Now they had an identity and significance untethered to their job or financial status, so they could walk away from it, if that was called for, or pick it up again, or approach it in a different way from before. They had a new freedom, both from their work and in their work. Notice that when Jesus called them to follow him, it was at the moment of great financial success, the huge catch of fish. But they could, and they did, leave their nets behind. In Jesus' presence, they were no longer controlled by their work. This may all sound very idealistic to us. After all, the sea wasn't going to run out of fish, and there were no fishermen bosses who were going to block their re-entry to the profession after their unpaid leave with Jesus. But the story forces us to ask important questions. Do we let our work control us to such a degree that we don't even notice when God comes through with a new opportunity? Do we get our big catch, a year-end bonus or next new job, and immediately start focusing on the prospect of the next bigger one? How can we have any freedom from the temptations of work and still keep our job? A fascinating example of this freedom is found in the second book of Kings, chapter 5. After Naaman, the prime minister of Syria, is converted to faith in Israel's God, he does not abandon his job. Instead, he takes a load of dirt from Israel to kneel on whenever he does his state duty of accompanying the king of Syria into the temple of Rimmon, the Syrian deity. Rimmon was basically a divinized version of Syria itself. So Naaman says, in effect, I will still serve my nation, but I will no longer worship my nation. Syria's national interests are important to me, but are no longer my ultimate value or God. My friend in the private equity firm made a similar move when he waived his bonus from his organization's investment in a venture that was perfectly legal but did not help people flourish. For both of these men, an encounter with God gave them the power to break free of the idols of their vocational fields. This power freed them from the grip of the work beneath their work. We have said that the gospel replaces the story that animates our work. It alters our conception of what work is, and it reorients the ethical compass we use for work. In addition to all this, the gospel also gives us new power for work by supplying us with a new passion and a deeper kind of rest. The power of true passion. One of the words we read and hear about often today is passion. Passion leads you to excel in whatever you do. But there are different sources and kinds of passion. Sometimes it generates frenetic activity more grounded in fear of failure than in pursuit of success. That kind of passion can introduce a lot of energy, but from a Christian point of view, it is a counterfeit. It is fueled by the work under the work, and it is unsustainable, like the extreme brightness of a dying light bulb. Dorothy Sayers helps us understand the counterfeit passion that can drive our work. In her book, Creed or Chaos, Sayers addresses the traditional seven deadly sins, including acedia, which is often translated as sloth. But as Sayers explains it, that is a misnomer, because laziness, the way we normally define sloth, is not the real nature of this condition. Acedia, she says, means a life driven by mere cost-benefit analysis of what's in it for me. She writes, "Acedia is the sin which believes in nothing, cares for nothing, enjoys nothing, loves nothing, hates nothing, finds purpose in nothing, lives for nothing, and only remains alive because there is nothing for which it will die. We have known it far too well for many years. The only thing perhaps we have not known about it is it is a mortal sin." Sayers goes on to say that a person characterized by acedia, in which their driving passion is for their own needs, comfort, and interests, does not necessarily look lazy at all. Indeed, this type of person seems to generate lots of activity. But, she argues, acedia, the sin of the empty soul, opens you to letting all the other sins be the motivations for your work. It is one of the favorite tricks of this sin to dissemble itself under a cover of a whiffling activity of body. We think that if we are busily rushing about and doing things, we cannot be suffering from sloth. Gluttony offers a world of dancing, dining, sports, and dashing very fast from place to place to gape at beauty spots. Covetousness rakes us out of bed at an early hour in order that we may put pep and hustle into our business. Envy sets us to gossip and scandals, to writing cantankerous letters to the paper, and to the unearthing of secrets and scavenging of desk bins. Wrath provides, very ingeniously, the argument that the only fitting activity in a world so full of evildoers and evil demons is to curse loudly and incessantly, "Whatever brute and blackguard made the world!" While lust provides that round of dreary promiscuity that passes for bodily vigor. But these are all disguises for the empty heart and the empty brain and the empty soul of acedia. In the world, it calls itself tolerance, but in hell, it is called despair. I find this point hits home as a brilliant exposition of idolatry. Without something bigger than yourself to work for, then all of your work energy is actually fueled by one of the other six deadly sins. You may work exceptionally hard because of envy to get ahead of somebody, or because of pride to prove yourself, or because of greed or even gluttony for pleasure. In short, acedia is the most subtle idolatry of all. It puts the cynical self at the center of your life. And when you do that, you release all the worst vices and sins to be the main animating energies behind your work. A main plot device of the Lord of the Rings trilogy is the corrupting effect of the Ring of Power. When you put on the ring, it magnifies your own will to power, and in doing so, it turns you evil. In a number of places where one of the hobbits puts on the ring, the description says something to this effect. When the ring goes on, you become the only real thing. You are a little, dark, solid rock in a ghostly world. Everything else is vague and shadowy. In some ways, our contemporary culture operates like the Ring of Power, magnifying the self-serving nature of sin in every human heart. It tells us in myriad ways every day that nobody has the right to tell us what is right or wrong for us. That in the end, there is no standard or authority higher than the choosing self. Our consciousness and our needs are more real than anything else outside us. There is nothing to which we should submit, nothing that may trump our own happiness without our permission, and there is nothing for which we should sacrifice our freedom. But in the Bible, the very definition of passion, think of Christ's passion, is to sacrifice your freedom for someone else. Romans chapter 12 addresses this truth at a practical level. Paul starts this way. I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifice. Romans chapter 12 verse 1. Paul is using temple language. He's leading us to think about a worshiper coming with an offering. But he's not talking about a sin offering, where you've sinned and are now reconciling with God. Rather, he's talking about a burnt offering, which had to be a choice animal from your flock, a strong one, without blemish. The burnt offering was offered as a way of showing your absolute commitment to God, as if to say, everything I have is yours with no reservations. In other words, it was an expression of passion. In fact, the term living sacrifice is deliberately paradoxical because sacrifices were dead. That's part of what it meant to be a sacrifice. To say to God's people, I want you to be a living slain thing, is meant to be a jolt. It's a way of saying you have to continually be in the rhythm of dying to your own interest and living for God. That's the passion God asks of you. What might this look like? The rest of Romans chapter 12 spells it out, but there is one particular verse from the passage that puts a fine point on what it means to be a living sacrifice. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Romans chapter 12 verse 11. There are two specifics in this verse. First, the word zeal is the translation of a Greek word meaning a combination of urgency and diligence. It is possible to be frenetic, to be urgent without focus and discipline. It is possible to be plodding or diligent without a sense of urgency. But God's charge means that you are to be both urgent and disciplined. Second, when the verse says, keep your spiritual fervor, the Greek literally says, as to your spirit boiling. So we are asked to bring emotion, discipline, and urgency to the task of being living sacrifices in the lives we lead and the work we do. We are asked to live with passion. So where does this true passion come from? Paul starts the whole chapter with, I urge you, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice. What is it about God's mercy that, if you viewed it, would allow you to become a living sacrifice, into a person who died to your own needs, who stopped doing the work under the work, and who transferred your passion to God? The answer, of course, is Jesus, the ultimate living sacrifice, and the ultimate form of God's mercy. When you see Jesus suffer and sacrifice for you, when his passion is burned into your imagination, it will become very clear whether the things you are passionate about are just forms of the other six deadly sins. But why was Jesus suffering? Where was his passion and sacrifice coming from? In John chapter 17, Jesus Christ looks at his disciples and says to the Father, "For them I sanctify myself." John chapter 17, verse 19. The original word, sanctify, meant to set yourself apart, like an Olympic runner. We know what it means to train for the Olympics. It means that absolutely everything in life is subordinated to one goal. It means that every minute of the day, every activity is done in such a way as to contribute to that aim. There is a great deal of pain every day, but it is endured without complaint. Only that level of passion and commitment can earn the gold. And so it was with Jesus and his passion. He set himself apart for the goal of our salvation. He lost everything, endured everything, to obtain it. Jesus Christ's passion was for you and for his Father, not for himself. There is our model. When the extent and depth of Jesus' passion for you fully draws on your heart, it will generate passion for the work he has called you uniquely to do in the world. When you realize what he has done to rescue you, your pride and envy begin to disappear because you don't need to get your self-worth from being richer, cooler, more powerful, or more comfortable. Instead of working out of the false passion of acedia, which is born of selfishness, you are working out of true passion, which is born of selflessness. You are adopted into God's family, so you already have your affirmation. You are justified in God's sight, so you have nothing to prove. You have been saved through a dying sacrifice, so you are free to be a living one. You are loved ceaselessly, so you can work tirelessly in response to a quiet inner fullness. The power of deep rest. There is a symbiotic relationship between work and rest. Of course, we know this at one level. We get away from work in order to replenish our bodies and minds. Resting or practicing Sabbath is also a way to help us get perspective on our work and put it in its proper place. Often we can't see our work properly until we get some distance from it and re-immerse ourselves in other activities. Then we see that there is more to life than work. With that perspective and rested bodies and minds, we return to do more and better work. But the relationship between work and rest operates at a deeper level as well. All of us are haunted by the work under the work, that need to prove and save ourselves, to gain a sense of worth and identity. But if we can experience gospel rest in our hearts, if we can be free from the need to earn our salvation through our work, we will have a deep reservoir of refreshment that continually rejuvenates us, restores our perspective, and renews our passion. To understand this deep rest, we need to look at the biblical meaning of the Sabbath to understand what it is a sign of and what it points to. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Deuteronomy, chapter 5, verses 12 through 15. Exodus chapter 20 ties the observance of a Sabbath day to God's creation, for God rested on the seventh day. What does this mean practically? Since God rested after his creation, we must also rest after ours. This rhythm of work and rest is not only for believers. It is for everyone as part of our created nature. Overwork or underwork violates that nature and leads to breakdown. To rest is actually a way to enjoy and honor the goodness of God's creation and our own. To violate the rhythm of work and rest, in either direction, leads to chaos in our life and in the world around us. Sabbath is therefore a celebration of our design. Deuteronomy chapter 5 goes on to tie the observance of Sabbath to God's redemption. Verse 15 says, "Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." God portrays the Sabbath day as a reenactment of emancipation from slavery. It reminds us how he delivered his people from a condition in which they were not human beings, but simply units of capacity in Pharaoh's brick production system. Anyone who cannot obey God's command to observe the Sabbath is a slave, even a self-imposed one. Your own heart, or our materialistic culture, or an exploitative organization, or all of the above, will be abusing you if you don't have the ability to be disciplined in your practice of Sabbath. Sabbath is, therefore, a declaration of our freedom. It means you are not a slave, not to your culture's expectations, your family's hopes, your medical school's demands, not even to your own insecurities. It is important that you learn to speak this truth to yourself with a note of triumph. Otherwise, you will feel guilty for taking time off, or you will be unable to truly unplug. The Sabbath legislation in Israel was enacted after the Exodus from Egypt. It was unique among world cultures at the time. It limited work, profit-taking, exploitation, and economic production in general. Every seventh day, no work could be done in the fields, and every seventh year, the field was to remain fallow and not be cultivated at all. This surely meant that in the short run, Israel was less economically productive and prosperous than its neighbors, but it was a land of free people. In the long run, of course, a deeply rested people are far more productive. We are also to think of Sabbath as an act of trust. God appointed the Sabbath to remind us that he is working and resting. To practice Sabbath is a disciplined and faithful way to remember that you are not the one who keeps the world running, who provides for your family, not even the one who keeps your work projects moving forward. Entrepreneurs find it especially difficult to believe this. They have high levels of competence and very few team members. If they don't put in the hours, things don't get done. How easy to fall prey to the temptation to believe that they alone are holding up their corner of creation. But by now you must see that God is there. You are not alone in your work. Jesus' famous discourse against worry, see Matthew chapter 6, verses 25 through 34, is set in the context of work. He chides us that the plants of the field are cared for, though they do not labor or spin. See verse 28. He reminds us that we are obviously more valuable to God than plants, so we shouldn't run after material things through our work. See verse 32. So if you are worrying during your rest, you are not practicing Sabbath. It is a chance to meditate on passages like Matthew chapter 6 until deep rest begins to penetrate you. We might conclude that the practical benefits of the gospel's Sabbath rest come to us only as individuals as we pray and read the Word, but that would be a mistake. God also strengthens us through the fellowship of community with other Christians. So, for example, Paul calls Christians to carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. See Galatians chapter 6, verse 2. And yet we are told that Jesus will relieve the burden, see Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30, and that we are to cast all our cares and burdens on God, see 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7, who bears them daily, see Psalm 68, verse 19. So, which is it? Are we to look to God to support us under our work and burdens, or to other Christian brothers and sisters? Obviously the answer is both, because it is normally through the sympathy and encouragement of Christian friends that we experience God refreshing us and supporting us in our work. The rest under the rest. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 through 30. To get the deepest picture of what can happen to our work after we meet Christ, look at this passage. When Jesus calls all people to himself, he says he knows we are weary and burdened, and that we need rest. But Jesus' cure for our weariness is a burden, see verse 30, and even a yoke, see verse 29. The yoke or harness put on a beast of burden was a symbol of slavery and grinding toil. How could this be a solution to the problem of deep weariness? Jesus says that it is his yoke and burden, and it is the only one that is light. Why? For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. Verse 29. He is the only boss who will not drive you into the ground, the only audience that does not need your best performance in order to be satisfied with you. Why is this? Because his work for you is finished. In fact, the very definition of a Christian is someone who not only admires Jesus, emulates Jesus, and obeys Jesus, but who rests in the finished work of Christ instead of his or her own. Remember, God was able to rest in Genesis chapter 2, verses 1, 2, and 3, only because his creative work was finished. And a Christian is able to rest only because God's redemptive work is likewise finished in Christ. When the work under the work has been satisfied by the Son, all that's left for us to do is to serve the work we've been given by the Father. We said before that many people are doing work under the work. They are not merely doing the work that draws the salary, they are also working to chase away their sense of insignificance. But here in Jesus we find the rest under the rest, the rem of the soul. Without it, all other work will be unsatisfying. You won't be able to relax, even when you are supposed to be resting. You will never be able to walk away from your nets, even for an evening. You won't be able to enjoy the satisfaction that God intended when he called us to the work he prepared for us. A classic example of this contrast is in the film Chariots of Fire, in which one man ran in the Olympics literally to justify my existence, while another man had such deep rest in Christ that he could miss a likely gold medal by not running on a Sunday. The first man had to get a medal because he was doing the work beneath the work. And, at least in the film, the gold medal wouldn't even be enough to give him the deep rest he sought. The second man, the devoted Christian, Eric Little, did not care in the same way whether he won Olympic medals or not. He was at rest. He told his sister that God had simply made him fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. He ran for the joy of running itself, and to delight the one who gave him the gifts to do so. Remember John Coltrane's quote at the beginning of this book? During the year 1957, I experienced, by the grace of God, a spiritual awakening which was to lead me to a richer, fuller, more productive life. At that time, in gratitude, I humbly asked to be given the means and privilege to make others happy through music, to inspire them to realize more and more of their capacities for living meaningful lives, because there certainly is meaning to life. I feel this has been granted through his grace. All praise to God. Coltrane was once like everyone else. He had said deep in his heart, If I get really good, if I'm successful, if people applaud and appreciate me, then I'll know I'm significant. I'll know my life is worth something. But that kind of inner dynamic does not usually produce the best work, or the deepest rest. As C.S. Lewis observed, "You will never make a good impression on other people until you stop thinking about what sort of impression you are making. Even in literature and art, no man who bothers about originality will ever be original. Whereas if you simply try to tell the truth, without caring two pence how often it has been told before, you will, 9 times out of 10, become original without ever having noticed it. Give up yourself, and you will find your real self." Something happened to Coltrane to reveal his self. One night, after an exceptionally brilliant performance of the suite A Love Supreme, a 32-minute outpouring of praise to God, he stepped down from the stage and was heard to say, "Nunc dimittis." These are Simeon's words in Luke chapter 2 after he had seen the promised Messiah. They mean essentially, "I could die happy now." Coltrane claimed to have had an experience of God's love that liberated him from the work, under the work, for the sake of the work itself. He had been given God's power, and had felt God's pleasure. Coltrane had stopped making music for his own sake. He did it for the music's sake, the listener's sake, and God's sake. In the Christian view, the way to find your calling is to look at the way you were created. Your gifts have not emerged by accident, but because the Creator gave them to you. But what if you're not at the point of running in the Olympics or leading on a world stage? What if you're struggling under an unfair boss or a tedious job that doesn't take advantage of all your gifts? It's liberating to accept that God is fully aware of where you are at any moment, and that by serving the work you've been given, you are serving Him. This is what Dorothy Sayers meant when she urged us to serve the work. And it is what Tolkien was getting at in Leaf by Niggle. When your heart comes to hope in Christ and the future world He has guaranteed, when you are carrying His easy yoke, you finally have the power to work with a free heart. You can accept gladly whatever level of success and accomplishment God gives you in your vocation, because He has called you to it. You can work with passion and rest, knowing that ultimately the deepest desires of your heart, including your specific aspirations for your earthly work, will be fulfilled when you reach your true country, the new heavens and new earth. So in any time and place, you can work with joy, satisfaction, and no regrets. You too can say, "Nunc dimittis." Epilogue. Leading People to Integrate Faith and Work. Redeemer Presbyterian Church has made vocational discipleship, helping people integrate their faith and work, a major focus of its overall ministry for almost 10 years. Our particular church community lives as resident aliens in a huge city with about 3% Christian. Many people are struggling to hold on to their faith as they try to contribute in their work communities. Others want their association with Jesus to be attractive. They don't want to widen the disconnect between the church and the people of the city. And still others are brand new to the Christian faith and don't have a clue what it means to be a follower of Jesus in their whole life, including work. The challenge is to deepen the faith and theology of our congregation, as well as enable them to engage the city with the love and truth of the gospel. We've sought to help our congregation live out the gospel in all spheres of culture in a way that seeks the peace and prosperity, see Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 7, of the city in which God has placed us. The letter that Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the elders, priests, and people of Israel who had been carried into exile in Babylon has been influential in establishing the purpose and the tone of our ministry. First of all, the letter makes it clear that the Lord God claims responsibility for carrying His people into exile in the first place. When facing the trials of life in the big city and the demands of a high-pressure career, it helps to remember God's sovereignty, so that, by definition, we can be sure we are where He wants us to be. Second, he asks his people to seek the peace and prosperity of Babylon, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. As a congregation, we understand ourselves to be a small minority whom God has called to love and serve the city, our professions, our workplace, and our neighborhoods. We seek to draw others into a redeeming and renewing faith, but also to serve alongside those who don't believe as we do, for the good of the city and the world. Discipleship for resident aliens or exiles is different from discipleship in a culture in which the Christian faith is assumed, and the goal is to draw people back into something the culture already tells them they should do. At Redeemer, we call the former exilic discipleship. Redeemer also has been shaped by a deep commitment to the promise that the gospel changes everything, in our hearts, our community, and our world. In the words of Abraham Kuyper, "There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, 'Mine.'" Our Faith in Work ministry has sought to explore the power and promise of the Christian story to change, redeem, and renew every aspect of our work lives, our work relationships, and the world we touch through the work we do. As we've attempted to lead people into a better integration of faith and work, it's been important to pay attention to who they are. Most are seriously career-minded, seeking careers in fields such as law, arts, finance, business, education, healthcare, technology, government, architecture, or advertising. They are also young, average age is 33, 70% are single, and they are early in their careers. After 9 years with more than 1,500 people involved and over 150 volunteer leaders, we have been able to identify some of the specific ways of thinking, stories or world views, and some explicit behaviors, practices or habits, that are foundational for our people to enable them to more fully live out the gospel in their work. When leading a change, it is helpful to think about where you are and where you're going. Imagine a chart with two columns. The left column lists various beliefs or ways of thinking that are the starting point for many people in our church. They are presuppositions that shape the story they live by, as we discussed in Chapter 9. The right column gives the corresponding belief that we teach, seeking to help them reshape the story by which they live. These ideas, when they become real enough to us, actually change how we think, feel, and act. Most of these ideas have been elaborated in detail in this book in far more elegant language. This list is simply how we capture these most essential mind shifts that move a person toward a fuller application of the gospel in their work. 1. Change from individual salvation to the gospel changes everything, hearts, community, and the world. 2. Change from being good to being saved. 3. Change from cheap grace to costly grace, awareness of our sin. 4. Change from heaven is up there to Christ will come again to this earth. 5. Change from God is value add to us to in God's providence, we could contribute to his work on earth. 6. Change from idols of this world to living for God. 7. Change from disdain of this world to engaged in this world. 8. Change from bowling alone to accepting community. 9. Change from people matter to institutions matter. And 10. Change from Christian superiority to God can work through whomever he wants. Common grace. Many young adults come to us from other cities and were raised in evangelical churches that limited their application of the gospel to individual salvation. A large part of our ministry is focused on broadening their understanding of the gospel to apply it to our communities, in the form of gospel-changed relationships, and our organizations, city, and culture. Many faith and work ministries focus on ethics, how to be good, honest, and fair. As we explained at the end of Chapter 7, it is very difficult, and even incompatible with the gospel, to just strive to be a good or heroic person like Esther. A focus on being good distracts us from coming to terms with our sin, and it is because of our sin that Christ needed to die. We want to help people understand that the more they can recognize their own sin, the more they will experience God's grace. A life of gratitude for being saved is far more pleasing than a life based on self-righteousness over being good. This leads us to the next point, that the price God paid for us was costly. As we contemplate the death of Christ on the cross for us, we are both humbled and motivated to give ourselves back to Him in return. The next two points also go together. A heaven with just our souls floating around is very different from one in which we're living in the most beautiful city we could imagine on this earth, a city in which our paintings of trees, see the introduction, or our clever new tools are more perfect than we could imagine them in this broken world. This understanding gives importance to the materiality of our surroundings. It gives us the motivation to give our best to contribute to the flourishing of the world now and this kingdom to come. Chapter 8 was about idols. Our idols block our relationship with God and make us proud. We try to help people identify the idols of their profession and the idols they use to cope with the thorns and thistles of life and the desperate peril of existence without God. Each time we strip away an idol, we can turn to God, and our trust in Him grows. In our individualistic environment, we have significant resistance to the biblical idea of community. Of course, everyone says they want community, friendship, and love, but mention the words accountability or commitment, and people run the other way. We work hard to demonstrate how God works in and through community. He even created the church so that we would work to share His gospel together. We also are constantly faced with the excellence and the generosity and the love of the people around us who don't know Christ. How can it be that the person I work with acts like a better person than the Christians I know? We get excited every time a famous football or basketball player is revealed to be a Christian, as though that somehow puts us in the excellence club in the eyes of the world. It's challenging to seek to be distinctive in how we work through the power of the resources Jesus has given us, and yet, at the same time, see hundreds of other people who don't have those gospel resources outperform and out-distinguish us. Understanding common grace is key to our humility and appreciation of God's sovereignty. The last thing we want to imply is that a gospel-filled work life is one of 10 key rules or ideas. That is the quickest way to become self-righteous and blunt the beauty of the gospel. But it has been helpful to us to have some of the ideas in this book boiled down to a few phrases so we can help coach people toward more theologically sound thinking about their lives at work. Instead, our prayer is that, in wrestling with who God is and how to relate to Him, our church will grow in humility, love, truth, grace, and justice, and that our neighbors in the city will flourish because we were here. Redeemer's Center for Faith and Work. In 2002, Redeemer Presbyterian Church reorganized to focus on 5 primary areas of ministry in New York City: worship and evangelism, community formation, mercy and justice, church planting, and faith and work. In recruiting me, Catherine, to create a faith and work ministry, Redeemer was beginning to develop a vision to renew the city's institutions of culture through the people of the congregation who were employed in vocations throughout the city. I was stunned by the enthusiastic response from the congregation. I've launched lots of new products or services in my life, spending months and huge budgets on advertising and promotion. But this time the phone started ringing before I was even officially introduced. Redeemer's CFW, which stands for Center for Faith and Work, started with no budget, but huge pent-up demand. In 2003, the congregation was approximately 3,000 worshipers a week, a good portion who were new to the Christian faith. Many were early in their careers and struggling to keep up with the daily demands of their work, let alone live out their faith. There was a dearth of mentors or role models within the church community. We held a series of classes, led by some elders, together with me, on topics such as vocational decision-making, leadership, and theology of work. We wanted to explore what the Bible had to say about concerns facing our congregation on a daily basis and to better understand our community's needs. A survey of several hundred participants in the classes revealed that 1. 6% had shared their faith in some way at work. 2. 55% prayed about their work. 3. 50% of all respondents responded affirmatively that they struggle to balance or integrate their desires with God's desires for their lives. And 4. Very few recognized any way their work itself contributed to society. In 2005, Redeemer was able to raise money through a church-wide capital campaign, enabling it to build out CFW over the next 5 years. The mission is to equip, connect, and mobilize our church community in their vocational spheres toward gospel-centered transformation for the common goal. Each of the goals of equipping, connecting, and mobilizing is important to help people work differently in light of the gospel. Many groups of Christians gather to meet one another, but without common frameworks for thinking about their faith, the discussions remain shallow. Churches often view themselves only in the business of teaching, assuming that if they've taught it, their congregation will apply it. But the study of adult learning has shown that people change only when they hear the new thinking, so we equip them, can discuss it among their peers, so we connect them, and apply it in simulated or actual situations, so we try to mobilize them. We also look at our programs in terms of the number of people they reach and the amount of resources we invest. The higher the commitment made by the participant, the more we'll invest. Hence, we make a significant investment in our intensive year-long Gotham Fellowship, which will serve 40 people in 2012 to 2013. We can diagram these various programs in the shape of a pyramid, with the base being broadest to show the largest number of people that can be involved in a program, and as we travel up the pyramid, showing their level of commitment, the number of people gets smaller, but the level of commitment grows. There's four levels to the pyramid. At the base, we have lectures, culture club events, and gospel and culture conferences. The next level up, we have vocation groups, retreats and classes, literary publications, art exhibits and performances. Traveling up the pyramid, those more committed members then can also take leader training and entrepreneurship initiatives. And finally, at the top of the pyramid, we have Gotham Fellowship. At the base of the pyramid, there are many in the congregation who can invest only a weekend for a conference or one night for a lecture. Many participants share the cost of these programs, albeit for a short-term commitment. A brief description of the programs developed by CFW can be found on our website, www.faithandwork.org, and I'll highlight some others in just a moment. Vocation groups. Vocation groups at Redeemer typically meet monthly and are sometimes supplemented with special speaker programs or social events. Each group is volunteer-led by a team, committed to helping others in their profession meet, deepen in their faith, and explore the challenges and opportunities of their field in the light of the gospel. The leader teams are innovative in their design of formats and topics. At the moment, Redeemer has numerous active vocation groups, actors, advertisers, architecture, engineering and construction, business, dancers, educators, entrepreneurs, fashion, film, finance, healthcare, higher education, information technology, international diplomacy, law, PhD students, visual arts, and writers. Gotham Fellowship. Gotham Fellowship, named after Washington Irving's nickname for New York, is an intensive 9-month theological and leadership development program for young professionals in all vocations. Studying original sources such as Augustine, Calvin, Owen, and Luther, the fellows grow in their ability to apply the gospel to their hearts, their relationships, and their understanding of their vocation. The program develops theological frameworks and spiritual practices that can be applied to the real-life situations of their work lives. In its fifth year, Gotham Fellowship has more than 100 alumni serving in the church and in their chosen fields, who also continue to meet together periodically to spur one another on to love and good works. See Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24. Entrepreneurship Initiative, EI. Redeemer has been committed to serving New York not only by helping plant new churches to reach out to those who don't go to church or follow Jesus, but also by helping build an ecosystem of organizations and institutions that serve the city. The EI supports entrepreneurs with a business plan competition that invites early-stage entrepreneurs to think more theologically and strategically about their ventures. Winners are given a small grant and coaching from more seasoned entrepreneurs in the church community. The EI has created a network of investors, senior leaders and coaches, experienced entrepreneurs, and early-stage entrepreneurs working together to serve the city with new gospel-centered ventures. Arts Ministries. Between 15% and 20% of Redeemer's congregation work in the arts, in music, theater, visual arts, dance, writing, design, and so on. Many artists in New York have felt particularly misunderstood or even rejected by the church because they are doing work that is not explicitly Christian, meaning directly for the church or containing an obvious Christian message. Our arts ministries engage artists in the theology of art and culture and provide opportunities for artists to share their work and collaborate on projects together. Church-based discipleship. Redeemer and CFW believe that it is extremely valuable to have the faith and work ministry integrated into the life of the church. Many people have asked if we plan to spin it off into its own independent nonprofit, and the answer is no. Our goal has been to model our conviction that vocational life is essential to being fully human in a biblical sense. Churches need to embrace the whole person, the married or single person, the healthy or ill person, the person at work, and the person at home. Church-based faith and work ministry is important for two reasons. One, work is often the crucible in which God shines a light on a person's idols and refines them in Christ-likeness. And two, the church is touching the world at large through the faithful presence of its people in the workplace. The last 10 years have shown us that faith and work ministry is so vital to the life of the congregation that it shouldn't be ignored. It draws in cultural influencers to become more shaped by the gospel. It provides the church a greater shared vision to serve the world, and it gives the church greater credibility in the culture in which it serves. While most churches are smaller than Redeemer, and would need to shape their ministry to integrate faith and work very differently, we encourage every church to develop something that fits its own context. Most churches could develop vocation groups to discuss the particular challenges and opportunities in their field for workers in three basic fields: business, arts, and human services. Alternately, the pastor could gather a group of 12 to 24 people in different professions to read a book like Oz Guinness's The Call or Al Walter's Creation Regained, and discuss its implications for their own lives. Redeemer has found that people are seeking far more theological study in order to navigate the challenges of their vocation, and they long for their pastor to be interested in learning more about the situations they face on a daily basis. This is Lloyd James. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Every Good Endeavor, Connecting Your Work to God's Work by Tim Keller. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by John McElroy. Every Good Endeavor is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc. Copyright 2012. All rights reserved. The book, Every Good Endeavor, is available wherever Dutton books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.